pulled out a cloth-wrapped rectangular object. I unwrapped it and examined it by the light of my lantern. It was my painting, in exactly the same condition as I'd last seen it in Wisteria Hollow's cellar.
"Satisfied?"
he asked. "Very. Thank you." I wrapped it back up in its padding, and he helped me tie it to the back of Beth's saddle. It wasn't ideal for transportation, but I felt confident the canvas wouldn't tear. A little bouncing wouldn't hurt it much. Beth and I rode off back on the black road to Cape Triumph. A quarter moon offered little guidance, and I was glad this was a well-worn and travelled road. When I reached the edge of the city, I ended up circling around it. Taking the extra time seemed like a better choice than being recognized. The road north was narrower than the one south, surrounded by thick woods that made the way even darker. I knew I should go slowly, in case of unseen obstacles, but I was growing uneasy about the passing time. It had to be after midnight, and I still had a lot of traveling to do, not to mention finalizing the paperwork back in Cape Triumph. There were only a few more witnesses in the trial. I didn't know how soon the tribunal would make a ruling. It was possible the paperwork might overturn a conviction. But I knew sometimes, especially for heretics, punishment was enacted immediately. I couldn't spare the time. I urged poor tired Beth into a hard gallop. For all my fine talk about being a great horsewoman, what I was doing was incredibly foolhardy. That was confirmed for me only a few minutes later when Beth suddenly stumbled, nearly throwing me and the painting from her back. She managed to catch herself just in time, but came to a quick stop, refusing to go further. I dismounted and tried to see what obstacle she'd tripped on. As it turned out, she'd lost a horseshoe.
"Damn it!"
I cried into the night. An owl answered in return. Further examination showed Beth didn't seem to have damaged her leg or hoof, but there was no way I'd be able to ride her at the earlier rate. And from her exhausted appearance, she probably wouldn't have let me do it much longer anyway. I got back on her. Even at an easier trot, every equestrian instructor I'd ever had would chastise me for this. It risked further injury. I hoped that wouldn't happen, just as I hoped the painting's buyer would sell me a horse. But Beth refused to budge. I was finally forced to go on foot, leading her behind me. Each step down the road was agonizing, not because of the physical toll, but the mental. I was weary and frustrated. The moon was traveling farther and farther across the sky, and all I could think about was how each delay put Cedric at risk. At least 2 hours had passed when I heard a thunder of hoofbeats behind me. I instantly became guarded, not knowing if this would be a help or hindrance. At the rate the riders were coming, there'd be no chance to divert into the woods, so I simply moved to the side and waited for what was to come. I put my hand on my knife. 5 men rode up, slowing when they reached me. One held a lantern. They all had weathered faces, with worn clothing suggestive of a laborious life. I didn't recognize any of them, but they recognized me.
"Countess," one said cheerfully, "we're here to escort you back to Osfrid."
Chapter 30 I took a step back, trying to calm my rapid breathing and pounding heart.
"You've made some mistake, sir," I said. "I'm a common laborer, making a delivery."
"A little late for that," said one of the other men. "Looks more to me like you're trying to run for it before things blow up in Cape Triumph. Not sure I blame you."
"We aren't going to hurt you,"
said the first man. He dismounted, and a couple of others followed suit.
"Just need to ship you back and collect our payday. Come with us,
and make it easy on everyone."
I tightened my hold on the knife and took another step back. I was almost off the road and wondered how far I'd get if I took off into the brushy woods. Probably not very. The terrain looked rough, and I'd likely fall over some log before getting 10 feet away.
"She ain't gonna make it easy."
The first man reached for me, and I swung out with the knife, cutting through his shirt and slashing shallowly across his chest.
"Bitch!" he cried. "Get her!"
The other men surged forward, and I knew I couldn't beat those odds. As with Warren's attack, I refused to make it simple for them. If they expected a woman to be easy prey, they'd soon learn otherwise. I dropped to the ground as they reached me, causing them to run into one another. I wiggled away as best I could, stabbing one man in the calf. I had the sense to yank the knife out and scurry away as he fell yelping to the ground. I scrambled to my feet and ran, but was quickly stopped. A hand grabbed my hair and jerked me backward.
I fell down, slamming the side of my head against the dirt road.
"Don't injure her," yelled their leader. "We need her intact."
"She's got 2 months at sea to heal," countered the man nearest me.
He tried to grab me, but a wild swing of the blade kept him at bay. His companions were moving in, and one finally managed to knock the knife out of my hand. Surrounded, I finally slowed down and accepted defeat. For now. They had to get me back to Cape Triumph and onto a ship. Plenty of time to escape. Sensing their victory, the men came to a standstill and awaited their next order. That moment of silence was suddenly filled with the pounding of more hooves. Everyone turned to stare down the road. Everyone except me. I used their distraction to slip through two men and grab my knife. But when the riders came into view, even I was taken aback. A man and a woman slowed before us. They both rode white horses and wore black masks across their eyes. The man nearest me gasped.
"Pirates!
Tom Shortsleeves!
And Lady Aviel!"
said another. He spoke the name like that of a demon. Ironic, since she bore the name of one of the six glorious angels. Ayana's words came back to me. All stories have a seed of truth. Legends come to life. I hadn't really believed the stories. So many rumors flew around Cape Triumph, and this had seemed particularly outlandish. But if these intimidating figures weren't really two of Cape Triumph's most notorious pirates, their impressions were so good that it didn't matter. They matched the descriptions I'd heard numerous times at parties, and, of course, from Mira, their biggest fan. Tom's sleeves were, in fact, short, and I could just make out the peacock feather in his hat. A mane of golden hair fell down Aviel's back, over a cape stitched with stylized stars. The two of them drew swords at the same time, their movements practiced and efficient.
"You have something we want," said Tom,
or whoever he really was.
"Leave Lady Whitmore with us and go."
Two of the men immediately began retreating, their faces full of fear. The gang's leader faced the riders down.
"She and her reward belong to us. Get out of here before we... Ah!"
Tom charged forward, slamming the pommel of his sword into the leader's head. Aviel moved just as quickly and went after another of the men. They might be outnumbered, but the horses gave them an advantage, since all of the other men had dismounted. The fear the twosome inspired was equally effective. Some of the raiders were trying to get away, and the one-eyed injured in the leg was having trouble moving at all. I took it all in as I hesitated on what to do. With the gang in disarray, I could easily join in with my knife and be effective, but as I watched Tom and Aviel swing their swords fiercely, I decided I didn't want to take my chances with this unknown element. It was time to run. I climbed back on Beth. With all the commotion, she was much more willing to carry me. We set off at a medium trot, not as fast as I'd like, but enough to get me away. My plan was to put some distance between me and the fray, then get off and take my chances with the woods. It would mean abandoning Beth and the painting, but this was the time for hard choices. I didn't get nearly as far as I'd hoped. In fact, I'd barely gotten started when Tom and Aviel overtook me and blocked the road ahead. I brought Beth to a halt and stared at these new threats. I tried not to get caught up in the mystique of their fearsome reputations, but it was hard not to.
"You don't need to worry about those men anymore," said Tom, almost cheerfully.
"Dead?" I asked.
"Maybe," said Aviel. "Or they ran."
She sounded like she had a Belgian accent. Tom's was solidly colonial.
"Well, it doesn't matter. I wasn't going with them, and I'm not going with you."
The boldness came automatically, even though there'd be little I could do against them. I'd revert to my plan to find a future escape.
"We don't want to take you away," Tom replied.
"Wherever you're going, we'll help you get there safely. We're your escorts for the night." I couldn't see their expressions in the darkness, but he sounded in earnest.
"Why? What do you want?"
"Nothing that you need to worry about. Our interests are our own. All you need to know is that you're safe with us." I didn't trust them. How could I? None of this made any sense. But then, according to all the stories, it was hard to guess the motives of these two. When I didn't speak, Tom added,
"Your horse is lame?"
"Not yet," I admitted. But she threw a shoe.
"Then we'll have to take you on ours."
I saw him glance over at Aviel. Something passed between them. Something a bit strained. And a moment later, she dismounted.
"Mine won't have trouble carrying, too,"
he said. You can ride hers.
Eyeing Tom's large Destria, I suspected the beast could carry 10. The smaller mare had seemed lively and energized back by the lantern, and I felt encouraged by the idea of having my own horse. It increased my getaway odds.
Okay, I said, walking over to her.
We're going to Crawford.
Aviel moved to the Destria, hesitating only a moment before effortlessly climbing on with Tom. I tethered Beth to a tree.
Sorry, girl. I patted her neck, feeling guilty about abandoning this gift. Hopefully we can get you back to Gideon, or maybe some new owner will get you a shoe.
I bound the painting to my new mount, and then we were off at a dizzying pace. The speed was exhilarating after Beth's slow gait, and I allowed myself to hope that this might work after all. But I hadn't even made it halfway to Crawford, and time was still my enemy. When we finally reached the edge of Crawford, Tom and Aviel slowed.
You have the address? He asked.
Yes.
Then it's probably best we wait here. Seeing us in the middle of the night might be alarming to some people.
I could believe that. Crawford was bigger than the last village, and it took some doing to find the right place. When I did, I could understand how this buyer could afford my painting. His house was by far the largest in town. A beautiful manor on the opposite side of the center green. Lanterns hung outside, but the windows were dark. Taking a deep breath, I retrieved the painting and knocked on the door. It took 2 more knocks before someone answered. A sleepy servant who eyed me askance. I need to see Mr. Davenport.
Madam, said the servant,
his tone suggesting that title was generous.
It's the middle of the night.
It couldn't be helped. I held up the wrapped painting. I have something he's very interested in buying. A painting. I think he'd be upset if he learned you turned me away, and I sold it to someone else.
The servant's change of expression told me he was familiar with the painting negotiations. He brought me into the foyer and warned me not to touch anything while he was gone. Minutes later, a grey-haired gentleman entered in a house robe. His eyes widened at the sight of me.
You're delivering the Theodoros?
If you still want it, I said. There's a Miracosi lady in Cape Triumph who's very interested. I unwrapped it, and he hurried forward, leaning close to the canvas.
Magnificent. I saw it 3 weeks ago, and couldn't get it out of my mind. I saw one of his other works in this series back on the continent. I was struck back then, too.
He gently touched the canvas.
See how the sun illuminates her. Theodoros knows his lighting.
A pang of guilt hit me. This man was a legitimate aficionado, and I was deceiving him. But was it so wrong, if it could give him joy and save a life? We completed the transaction, and I left his house with a heavy bag of gold. It occurred to me as I walked back to the road that Tom and Aviel might somehow know what I was doing and plan on taking my money. They materialized out of the shadows before I could consider any alternative courses of action.
All done? Tom asked, making no threatening moves. Then let's get you back.
Dawn is coming. Aviel remained quiet. In the light of the lanterns hanging in town, her hair glittered gold. Our journey back was frenzied as we tried to beat the sunrise. We were going too fast for me to see Beth, but I did notice the point where we'd had the altercation. The lantern still burned on the road, and 2 men lay prone nearby. I wasn't sure if they were dead or unconscious, and no one stopped to find out. Our speed was good, but not that good. The sun was touching the eastern horizon when we reached the outskirts of Cape Triumph. And here Tom and Aviel left me.
We disappear with the dawn, he said with a smile. But I hope you can handle things now.
I got off the mare. My legs were so stiff from all the riding that I nearly fell over. Thank you for your help. I couldn't have done this without you. I glanced at Aviel.
Either of you.
Our pleasure, he said.
She simply nodded in acknowledgement as she mounted her horse. He sketched me a bow from his saddle.
Que Arinial te garde, Lady Whitmore.
I couldn't help a smile, both at hearing a pirate perfectly deliver an old Lorandian proverb, and at having Arinial invoked on my behalf. Back at my parents' crypt, I dismissed the glorious angel who helped with safe passages, but I could certainly use her help now. I waved to the pirates, and their horses soon thundered out of sight. I walked into Cape Triumph alone.
I didn't know the exact time, but seeing so many businesses open didn't bode well. The trial would be starting soon. What would Cedric think when he didn't see me among the spectators? That I'd abandoned him? No. He knew me too well. He'd know I was working to save him. I just hoped I could do it. I went to Nicholas Addleton's home, and found him walking out the door. He sized me up from head to toe. I'm running late, and had planned to go to the courthouse. But it looks like you need me more. Gideon Stewart talked to you? About his tenuous plan? Yes. And I really didn't think it could be pulled off in time. Especially the part about the woman with nothing coming up with 500 gold. I pulled back my coat and showed him the money bag. He shook his head and laughed. Never a dull moment with you. Will you help us? I know it's a lot to ask after everything we— Miss Bailey, he interrupted. Let's go find the Westhaven representatives. They were staying at an inn in town, one of the nicer ones. The common room here was quiet and orderly, and Nicholas and I sat at a table while the innkeeper fetched the Westhaven representatives. I yawned once, then again. You look like you're ready to fall asleep, Nicholas said. Just need a quick break, I said, then I'll get a second wind. Or maybe I'm on to my third or fourth at this point. I could tell he was struggling to say what came next. Adelaide, you didn't do anything, illegal to get that money, did you? No, I reconsidered. Well, not exactly. Maybe kind of. I don't know. No one was hurt, if that makes you feel better. Somewhat. A man and a woman approached our table. They looked respectfully middle class, and were dressed no differently than anyone else. After seeing the Grashand residence, I wasn't sure what to expect from those working toward a religiously tolerant colony. I'm Edwin Harrison, and this is my wife Mary. The man looked us over, no doubt perplexed by the extreme contrast in my and Nicholas's attire. Is there something we can help you with? We'd like to buy a stake in Westhaven, said Nicholas. Edwin instantly transformed. Absolutely! How wonderful! We're so eager to have more people join our endeavor. Dear, would you go get one of the contracts? He turned back to us while she went upstairs. You must tell me more about yourselves, Mr. and Mistress. Nicholas and I exchanged amused looks. It's not for us, I said, though I would be affected if this worked. It's for someone else. A little of Edwin's enthusiasm diminished. That's highly irregular. The man in question is detained, explained Nicholas. I'll be serving as proxy. Highly irregular, Edwin repeated. Mary returned with several pieces of paper. I'm his attorney, Nicholas told them, and this young lady is his wife, I finished. Nicholas hesitated as he took that in, and then made a quick recovery. And should Mr. Harrison doubt that, you could, of course, show him the proof. It's with the magistrate in Haddison, I said. Giving that up was a big secret, but legally I should have a fair amount of power to act on Cedric's behalf, especially with Nicholas as legal backup. Considering the trouble we were already in, revealing our marriage couldn't really make things worse. Never a dull moment, Nicholas murmured with a half-smile. He turned back to the Harrisons. So you see, there's no problem with our going forward for him. Edwin wavered a bit more, and then conceded. Very well, then. We're eager to begin our work with those passionate about our vision. He and Nicholas began going over the paperwork. I knew a little bit about the terms from Cedric, but hearing it laid out in detail was fascinating. Most of the other colonies were founded on orders of the king, who then appointed governors and other prominent leaders. Westhaven's founding had been initiated by the crown as well, following ceding of the land by the Ikori in another morally questionable truce. Unlike other colonies, the crown operated this one as a business, in response to those clamoring for freedom to practice their faith. The priests of Euros might want to hunt down and persecute heretics, but the king found it easier to simply ship them off. Essentially, we are buying from the crown the right to lead Westhaven, though we are still a royal colony under Osfrid, Edwin explained. Each stake helps pay off that price. We're nearly there, and can begin officially drawing up charters, though we've begun some rough drafts already. Those doing the early buy-ins can take part in the planning. From that group, we'll elect who fills the important positions.
Eventually, all citizens will participate in such an election. But that's further down the road.
And all faiths can worship there, I said.
Mary gave me a gentle smile.
Yes, that's our primary purpose.
Nicholas read each part in detail, suggesting a few clarifications that the Harrisons had no quarrel with. When Nicholas was satisfied, he wrote out the final affidavit on Cedric's behalf, reaffirming a commitment to Westhaven and its laws. He signed as proxy, and then looked up, his pen hovering over the paper.
I have a bit more irregularity to suggest, but we'd like to backdate this as well.
Edwin frowned.
How far?
About 3 weeks, I said.
Some might consider that perjury, said Edwin pointedly. Something I'm sure a man of the law would know.
If you don't do it, Cedric will die, I blurted out. He's on trial, for Alonzan heresy, and we need to claim Westhaven's amnesty.
The troubled look in Edwin's eyes didn't reassure me, but Mary laid her hand over his.
Dear, isn't this what the point is? To prevent this kind of atrocity?
Edwin took a few more moments and then exhaled.
Date it, he told Nicholas.
Nicholas did, and then Edwin signed underneath as witness, also using the early date. He took my hard-earned money. I felt like crying, but maybe that was the lack of sleep.
Thank you. Thank you, you have no idea.
The inn's door burst open, and a wide-eyed laborer peered in.
A hanging! There's going to be a hanging! They convicted that Alonzan devil!
Nicholas groaned, but I was already on my feet.
No, no! We are not too late! We can't be!
I grabbed the papers and sprinted for the door. Nicholas caught up quickly.
Wait for me. The rabble loves an execution. It'll be madness out there.
He was right. We joined a flood of people heading across town, eager for blood. I wished we had horses, but wasn't sure we would have gotten far in this crowd. I tried to fix my mind on the journey, not imagining what might happen to Cedric if I didn't make it.
I knew it could be soon, I called to Nicholas over the noise. But I hoped not this soon.
The governor makes the call on when the sentence is carried out, Nicholas said. And this governor is pretty motivated to see this so-called justice done. I'm sure they'll delay enough to get a good crowd. They like an audience. Scares people into behaving.
The thought of Cedric's execution was beyond comprehension. What if they did it? And I wasn't there in his last moments. The courthouse came into sight. They'd already put up the gallows, and a few dark figures stood on it. One almost certainly was Cedric. The crowd bottlenecked when we finally reached our destination. Everyone wanted a good view, but they could only get so close. No one wanted to give up the spot they'd fought for, so pushing our way forward was difficult. Near the back I caught sight of Ayana. She had a hand to her eyes, to shield against the sun, and was scanning the crowd. She hurried over.
Adelaide,
I wondered where you were. Have you seen Mira?
No, but I thought she'd be here. I have to get through, I said urgently. I have to get up there.
She joined us unhesitatingly, and Nicholas asked, was Warren Doyle exonerated? She scowled and nodded. Ayana helped shove our way through the crowds. We received a lot of angry curses, but pushed on anyway. It was still slow going, and we were barely halfway through when Governor Doyle moved to the front of the gallows. I could see Cedric clearly now, his good arm bound behind his back, and my heart sank. Warren stood nearby, with a hooded hangman.
"Good citizens of Denham," the governor shouted. "We are here to see justice done, to help purify our colony, and drive off evil forces within it."
The crowd had quieted a little, and I decided to take my chances.
"Governor Doyle!"
I shouted.
"Governor Doyle!"
He didn't hear, but a few irritated bystanders shushed me. I attempted to move closer.
"Today I give you a heretic. Not just any heretic, but one of the foul Alonzans," hisses sounded around us. "One who practices dark arts and has unholy communion with the six wayward angels."
I'd gotten a little closer and tried again.
"Governor Doyle!"
He still didn't hear, but those in front of me turned around to see what was happening. They gave way to me out of simple curiosity, and my next attempt was heard.
Governor Doyle!
He searched for the voice and spotted me.
Lady Whitmore! You missed the trial!
The crowd parted for me, and getting to the front was easy. I hurried to the gallows stairs, locking eyes with Cedric. A couple of soldiers started to block me, but Warren shook his head at them. Let her say goodbye. There was no kindness in his voice. I held the papers in the air.
You can't execute him! He's a citizen of Westhaven. I have the proof. He's allowed to practice there, and you have to honor that here.
Warren's condescending look turned into a snarl.
Take your forged papers and get out of here.
They're not forgeries, Nicholas called from below. He and Diana had worked their way up in the crowd.
I'm an attorney, and I completed them with Westhaven's chief representative. Everything's in order. Mr. Thorne's citizenship was intact the day you found the Alonzan items.
How convenient this just surfaced, snapped the governor.
You should have presented this evidence before the verdict. This demon will be brought to justice, and I'll be damned if—
He trailed off as his eyes lifted to something beyond me. I stood on my tiptoes and tried to see what had caught his attention. A group of riders was charging down the road, oblivious to anything in their way. The panicked crowd split up, frantic to get to safety.
"Governor!" cried one of the men when they were within hearing. "The Ikori are here! A whole force of them!"
Governor Doyle regarded the man as if he was crazy.
"There haven't been Ikori in the city in years, or anywhere in Denham."
The man pointed.
"They're right behind me! Call the soldiers!"
But as I'd noticed before, Cape Triumph didn't have a large military presence. There had been no need, now that threats from the Ikori and Lorandians were non-existent. The Crown had diverted the bulk of its might to more vulnerable colonies, leaving the old fort all but abandoned. Today, crowd management was being handled by scattered militia and a handful of remaining soldiers. I had a hard time believing the Ikori claim, too. But then I saw what came down the road next. A pack of nearly 50 horses approached, surrounded in a cloud of dust. As they grew closer, I saw the bright colors of plaid wool draped over the riders. Sunlight shone on heads of red and gold hair. Equally visible were swords and shields. Chaos ensued. The crowd broke, screaming as they ran for what they hoped was safety. Governor Doyle began shouting for the militia to assemble, but it was nearly impossible to manage in this frenzy. I urgently beckoned Nicholas to come up the steps with me. I didn't know what was happening, but I wasn't going to leave Cedric tied up when a battle was about to start. I ran over to him and sliced his ropes.
"You're okay? You're okay?"
I asked, taking in the beloved features.
"Yes, yes."
He touched my cheek briefly and peered around, having the same sentiment as me.
"We need to get out of here. Up the North Highway, take to the woods."
Nicholas nodded. "We can get help in the towns there. Maybe make it to Archerwood Colony. Their militia's bigger, and they still have some army left." We turned for the gallows stairs and found Warren blocking our path. Amazingly, only an hour after being found not guilty, he'd gotten a hold of a gun. "You're not leaving," he said. "Maybe we're all going to die here, but I'm going to be the one who finishes you." I glanced frantically at the approaching Ikori. They hadn't attacked, but there'd been no need, with everyone fleeing. The militia had finally started to assemble, but so far there were only about 2 dozen.
"Stop this," I told him. "This isn't the time for a vendetta. You can get away with us. We're going north."
"Save your own skin," added Cedric. "You're good at that."
It wasn't perhaps the most tactful comment to use when trying to sway Warren to our side, but I doubted anything would have. A voice suddenly boomed.
"Where is the governor?"
We all turned. The Ikori had reached the bottom of the platform. There'd still been no sign of attack. They seemed remarkably calm, though those in the group's periphery watched the colonists warily and held their weapons tightly. Many were painted with blue woad, just like the 2 Ikori we'd met on the road, covered in symbols I didn't know. Women warriors rode along with the men. Copper ornaments and feathers decorated riders and horses, and their woolen tartans made a sea of color. Looking closely, I could see a pattern to it. Several riders to the side wore plaid of red and white. Another cluster wore red and blue. The group in the front wore green and black. This was the group the speaker was in. He was in front, all tanned muscles and white blonde hair, and he was the Akori we'd met on the road to Haddison.
"Where is the governor?"
His Osfridian was still clear. Governor Doyle hesitantly stepped forward.
"I'm the governor. You have no business here. Get out before my army beats yours to the ground."
It was a bluff, seeing as the militia had 30 at most by now. I think several had fled.
"We do have business," the Akori man said. "We've come seeking justice. Your help in righting a wrong done to us."
His eyes flicked toward Warren.
"I was told we'd need more than two people to have our demands heard. So here we are." "You've had no wrongs done to you," said Governor Doyle. "We've all agreed to the treaties. We've all obeyed them. You have your land, we have ours. Soldiers are moving into our land and attacking our villages. Soldiers from the place you call Lorendy."
The Akori man met the governor's gaze unblinkingly.
"And your own people are aiding them and letting them cross your territories."
This caused a nervous stir among our colonists, but Governor Doyle only grew angrier.
"Impossible! Lorandians moving into your lands means they would flank ours. No man among us would allow such a thing." "Your own son would!"
A new speaker emerged from the Akori, bringing her horse beside the man. And I knew her. I hadn't picked Tamsin out right away. Her red hair had blended into theirs, and she was dressed like them too, in a knee-length green dress edged in that plaid. Her hair hung in two long, loose braids, intertwined with copper pendants. I'd been stunned when I saw her with the Grashand residents, but this was enough to make me think I was imagining things. Her entire presence was calm and composed, very different from the wildly emotional demeanor I associated with her.
"Your son and other traitors are working with the Lorandians to stir up discord and draw Osfrid's army out of the central colonies so that Haddison and others can rebel against the crown."
Warren lowered the gun and came to life beside us.
"It's a lie, Father. There's no telling what these savages have brainwashed this girl into believing. What proof does she have for this absurdity?"
"The proof of being thrown off a boat in the middle of a storm when I discovered your plans," she replied.
"Lies," said Warren.
He took a few steps back, panic filling his face.
"This girl is delusional."
A man suddenly climbed up the stairs. Warren spun around to face this newcomer. It was Grant Elliot, looking particularly bedraggled today, and he didn't seem fazed by any of this. He strolled over beside me and looked as though a halted hanging, an Akori army and potential traitors were part of an ordinary day for him.
"She's telling the truth," he said, locking his hard gaze on Governor Doyle and not Warren. The gruff Grant I remembered from the storm was back.
"There are stacks of correspondence. Witnesses will testify."
"Elliot?"
Warren gaped.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
Grant's heavy gaze fell on Warren.
"I think you know. About Court Marsh? About the heretic couriers?"
I saw the shift in Warren's eyes, the moment when he was truly pushed over the edge by whatever those enigmatic words meant. And I knew, before he raised the gun at Grant, what was going to happen.
"Look out!"
I cried, throwing myself into Grant. I didn't quite knock him over, but pushed him out of the way enough to just barely evade the bullet that fired from Warren's gun. That put me directly in front of him for the gun's second bullet, and I could tell from his frantic expression that it didn't really matter who he shot at this point. Suddenly I heard a thwack sound, and something moved in my periphery. The next thing I knew, Warren was lying on the ground, clutching his leg and screaming in agony. Something that looked like an arrow was sticking out of his knee. It was the same leg I'd stabbed him in. Grant knelt down to restrain Warren, but that seemed unnecessary, given the wails of pain. I, like many others, tried to figure out where the shot had come from. The Akori and the feeble militia looked equally baffled. At last, I found what I'd been searching for. And I couldn't tell in that moment which was more incredible, that Tamsin was among the Akori warriors, or that Mira was standing on an overturned wagon wielding a crossbow.
Chapter 31. My second wedding was bigger than my first one, and a lot cleaner. I would certainly still argue that I didn't need ceremony or pomp to declare my love for Cedric. A bath and nice clothes didn't change how I felt.
but there was no way I'd turn them down. In Adoria, weddings occurred in magistrates' offices more often than they did in Osfrid, so choosing that over a church of Euros wasn't unusual. Of course, with Cedric revealed as an Alanzan, no one was really surprised. We held our after-wedding party at Wisteria Hollow, inviting everyone we knew, and a lot of people we didn't. Jasper had grudgingly agreed to hosting. He still wasn't happy about his son's choices, but he'd given in and accepted the inevitable. We spent our wedding night in the cottage of an Alanzan acquaintance of Cedric's, one who was out of town on business and had lent it to us. It held nothing of my old townhouse's grandeur, or even that of Blue Spring, but was charming and clean. And it was ours, all ours for the night. No fear of others discovering us, no fear of condemnation. It felt like we hadn't really and truly seen each other in ages. Since almost no one knew we were already married, we'd spent the 2 weeks between the trial and official wedding living chaste and separate lives. When we'd made it back to the cottage after a long day of festivities, the jolt of finally being alone together had been so surreal that we'd hardly known what to do. But we'd quickly figured that out. I woke the next morning to sunlight streaming in through the bedroom's bay window. Cedric lay at my back, his arms encircling my waist. I ran my fingers over the crisp white sheets, inhaling a scent that was a mix of Cedric's vetiver, the detergent used on the sheets, and the violet perfume Mira and Tamsin had gifted me for my wedding. "I can tell that you're thinking," Cedric said, pressing his cheek to my back. "Thinking much harder than you should be. I'm trying to memorize this. Every detail. The light, the smells, the feel." I rolled over so that I could look at his face. The morning sun lit up his hair, which was unquestionably disheveled. "Even you. We get to wake up together for the rest of our lives now. But it's going to be a long time before it resembles anything like this room, this bed." He brushed my hair back, and then trailed his hand along my neck. "Getting cold feet? Hardly, seeing as I've married you twice now. Maybe we can find a reason to stay here longer. And miss going to Westhaven with the charter members. That wouldn't reflect well on a founder and so-called leader of the community. You'd also get arrested and possibly executed for heresy if you don't go, and all those food supplies we've got sitting downstairs would go to waste. Was that list in any particular order, like least to most serious consequence?" "I don't know." The hand that had been by my face had slipped under the covers and now ran over my bare leg, slowly, agonizingly. I was trying to keep my face and voice cool, but the rest of my body was betraying me as I curled closer to him. "You're kind of making it difficult to focus, and we have a lot to do." "Yes." His voice was husky as he moved his mouth to my neck. "Yes, we do." "That's not what I..." He was impossible for me to resist. Or maybe I was impossible for him to resist. We melted into each other. And I forgot all about Westhaven and the hardships ahead. For the next hour my world was a tangle of skin and hair and bedding. Afterward I had a half-hearted urge to get up and start the day. That was soon abandoned. I collapsed into him and fell back asleep. The sound of knocking snapped me awake and effectively shattered any remaining languor. I jerked upright. "They're here for our supplies. What time is it?" Cedric opened one eye and fixed it on the window. "It's not time. Too early." "Well, someone wants something," I said as the knocking continued. I climbed out of bed and searched around until I found a long, thick housecoat. I pulled it on, noting that my wedding dress was lying on the floor in the room's far corner, inside out. It was one of my diamond dresses, a fantasy of white silk and silver. How'd that get over there? Cedric had been watching me dress, both eyes now open, and slid his gaze over to the corner. "You needed help getting out of it." Like that was any kind of answer. "We'll get an earful from Jasper. I have to give that back." I finished cinching up the robe and hurried to the bedroom door. "I think you're supposed to call him Dad now," Cedric yelled after me. I paused just long enough to throw a small pillow at him. Downstairs the knocking had grown louder and more irritated, so perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised to find that it was, in fact, Jasper standing out on the porch. He checked his pocket watch impatiently. "There you are!" "Sorry, we were still asleep. Would you like to come in?"
No time. I'm off to meet a man I might possibly be starting an exciting business venture with.
And he had to schedule it during our send-off, huh? Cedric strolled to the doorway beside me, yawning. He'd thrown on last night's wedding clothes, which were covered in wrinkles. Or maybe you scheduled it during the send-off.
Jasper didn't answer either way.
There's nothing you really need from me at this point, although I do need that dress back. I can get good money for that. And if this new venture works out, we might have the potential for even more. We're working out logistics for more specific long-distance matchmaking, via correspondence and classified ads.
While Jasper rambled on about the details, I went back upstairs to get the dress. It took a few minutes to assemble it all, as the various components, overdress, underdress, chemise, veil, had inexplicably ended up in wildly different parts of the room. Maybe I'd had more wine last night than I recalled. Or maybe I'd just been too preoccupied to care. Several glittering beads fell off the overdress when I smoothed it out, and I winced, hoping Jasper wouldn't notice. When I came back downstairs, I heard Jasper saying, "Expand this business more than we ever dreamed, and you could have had a share of it. Riches beyond belief. But no, you had to marry a blue-blooded con artist and go prance off into the wilderness with some cult. I hope this new insanity works out for you."
"Father, that might be the nicest thing you've ever said to me."
Jasper scowled. "I'm serious. You've made some dangerous choices."
"But I made them myself," Cedric said, "and that's what matters."
I handed the dress over to Jasper.
From the narrowing of his eyes, I think he immediately noticed the missing beads.
"Is that wine on the hem?" he asked.
"Thank you for letting me borrow it," I said sweetly. "Dad?"
Cedric and I stood on the porch when he left, watching until he was out of sight down the lane. When we were alone, he slipped his arm around me.
"Ready for the next adventure?"
"Always."
The morning flew by, as we readied ourselves, and saw our wilderness supplies and few worldly possessions carted off to the Westhaven baggage train. Much like the Haddison send-off, there was a big crowd assembling at the edge of town where the wagons and horses were lining up for departure. There'd be family and friends to say goodbye, as well as the idle and curious. When we were finally ready to go, Cedric and I cast a fond glance back at the cottage and went to join the masses. It was as crowded as I'd expected, maybe more so. Edwin Harrison caught sight of us immediately and asked for Cedric to consult on something, leaving me alone to people-watch near the edge of the crowd.
"It must be exhausting being married," Tamsin strolled up to me. "You look like you didn't sleep at all."
I grinned and gave her a quick hug.
"I slept. Some."
"Well, I'm sure you'll make up for it, with all the sleep you'll get trekking through the wilderness. And whatever shack you have in Westhaven will probably be very restful, too."
I thought back to the dilapidated shanty on the gold claim. It felt like a lifetime ago.
"We don't even have one yet. We'll have to build it. Or hire someone to, in light of Cedric's carpentry skills. Besides, you're one to talk, after living in an Ikori roundhouse."
She smiled at the joke, but made no comment on it. In the weeks that had passed since Warren's downfall, we'd learned a lot more about her time among both the Grashand heirs and the Ikori. She'd taken a long time to open up, and I knew there were still things she wasn't telling us. I hoped they'd come out in time when she was ready. Ayana had cornered Jasper, telling them that there was no way Tamsin could be expected to marry any time soon, after such traumatic events. Ayana had won her case, and Tamsin's contract had been extended. She turned away and stared vacantly at the sea of people.
"There's something... well, that is... there's something I need to talk to you about. Something I have to ask you."
Her sober expression was startling. Frightening, even, seeing as I'd thought the worst of her troubles were over. I squeezed her hand. "Of course."
"It might be too late. I should have brought it up sooner. But I didn't want to burden you with everything else. But I know you and Cedric made a lot of money from selling the Haddison claim, and so I thought... that is...
Tamsin." I'd never heard her ramble in all our time together.
"You can tell me anything. Go ahead and ask whatever you need to."
So she did.
I fell silent for a long time afterward, trying to wrap my mind around what I'd just heard. The longer I didn't speak, the more troubled she became.
You think I'm a terrible person, don't you?
What? Of course not.
I drew her to me again. I remembered when long ago she'd told me I had no idea how much she had on the line. And she'd been right.
I'm just surprised, that's all. And of course I'll help.
Her brown eyes shone with tears.
It's a lot to ask. And I understand if Cedric doesn't want you to spend the money. It is right to...
Cedric wouldn't mind. And it doesn't matter. I don't need to touch the Haddison money. I scanned the crowd, half hoping Nicholas Addleton might have turned out. No such luck. Legally, I probably didn't need his help, but he certainly would have made things neater. After substantial evidence had condemned Warren to a ship back to Osfrid to answer for his multi-layered conspiracy, a legal nightmare had ensued over the land he owned in Haddison. In matters of treason, land like that usually reverted to the crown. But he'd had a number of leaseholders working the land, and in a generous gesture, the courts had ended up gifting those claims. Rather than deal with the excavation, Cedric had sold his for an impressive price, giving us the means to pay off my contract and build savings for Westhaven. Nicholas had been instrumental in helping us sort matters out, so I suppose he'd earned a break from us. I spied one of the Westhaven labourers nearby, keeping track of inventory with a pen and sheaf of paper. I talked him into lending the pen and giving me a piece of paper. He was one of those who was starstruck over the truth about my past, and when I thanked him, he simply stammered,
"No problem, m'lady."
I knelt down to make a desk out of my knees and began writing. I, Elizabeth Thorne, nay Whitmore. I stopped, unsure what to write next. Using my legal first name wasn't the issue. It was what came next. Or did anything come next? I'd been gone more than a year. My cousin Peter would most certainly carry the exalted Rupert's title now. I, Elizabeth Thorne, nay Whitmore, former Countess of Rothford, authorize the release of my surety money to Lady Alice Whitmore, to be spent in the terms outlined below. Tamsin watched me write each word, and I was pretty sure she didn't breathe the entire time. When I signed and finished, she read it over again, and then looked at me hopefully.
That's all it'll take?
It should be. That money's been isolated from any family debt for years, and is legally mine, now that I'm married. It's not a lot. If it was, I would have had fewer problems. But it's enough for what you need, and Grandmama will see that everything gets followed through. I reached into my skirt pocket and produced a folded bundle of more paper. Along with a copy of my marriage certificate, it also contained a long overdue letter.
I'll just add it to what I'm already sending her.
Silas Garrett is supposed to deliver it, and verify that he compared me to the portrait and saw me alive. I'm just not sure where he is. Tamsin pointed. He's over there, speaking with that awful Grant Elliot. He seemed so polite at first, but he's actually got quite an attitude, you know. Sure enough, the two of them stood removed from the throng, having what looked like a friendly conversation. I still didn't know their exact connection, save that they'd both played a part in having Warren arrested. Silas was transporting Warren back to Osfrid for a treason trial while Grant remained behind in the colonies. "He can't be that awful," I told Tamsin as we walked toward them. "They say he was responsible for the evidence tying Warren to the Lorandians." "Well, I'm just glad he finally seems to have shaved," she said.
"He has, hasn't he? The beard looks much neater than usual."
Grizzled Silas gave me a nod of greeting when we reached them.
"Mistress Thorne, I wondered when I'd see you. Congratulations."
"Thank you." I handed the bundle of papers to him. "It should be easy to find my grandmother. I'm sure she'll still be in Osfro." Silas tucked the papers into his coat's inner pocket. "I'll find her."
"Anything else you need me to deliver?"
I shook my head, but Tamsin hesitantly stepped forward.
"If it's not too much trouble, Mr. Garrett, I also have some letters. The address is in Osfro. I can pay you."
"Just get them to me before we sail in 2 days," Silas said.
"How is your prisoner?" I asked.
"Miserable," Grant answered. He grinned, and I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be charming or terrifying. "He's locked up in the ship's hold, and I visit him every day, just to make sure he stays miserable."
Mira joined us, overhearing that last comment.
"He's probably going to be executed in Osfrid for treason. I don't think you have to worry about him feeling cheerful any time soon."
"That conniving bastard's treachery nearly started a war that would have drawn in Osfrid, the The Akori, Lorendi, the Balanquins, and Eurus knows who else. It would have ravaged this land and cost countless lives. So I don't really think it's overkill to make sure he's suffering. Grant paused, almost eloquently. I like to be thorough. Mira rolled her eyes and turned to Tamsin and me. Can we talk? We made our goodbyes to the men and wandered away. Tamsin had nearly wept after I'd written the letter, thanking me profusely. But her face was alight now in that endearing, cunning way. Are you finally going to tell us, Mira? She demanded. Surely you won't let poor Adelaide go off into some forsaken land without telling her what you're going to do. It'd be so cruel. She'll worry the whole time. Mira had told us recently that she'd made a decision about her future. But we had no idea what it was. Maybe she'd decided to marry the elderly gentleman. Maybe she'd decided to go back to Osrid and work. Neither of those seemed likely, though, given the smile I kept seeing on her face. After her spectacular attack on Warren, which I'd learned was credited to Ayana's training, nothing Mira did surprised me anymore. And it seemed the mystery would continue a little longer. Sorry, Mira said. I can't tell you yet. But soon.
So cruel, repeated Tamsin.
Mira caught me in a tight embrace. Mostly I just wanted to come tell you goodbye. It seems like we're always doing that, doesn't it? I pulled Tamsin into our hug. And we always keep coming back together. I'm sure I'll be able to get back to Cape Triumph once in a while. And I hope you'll come visit me in Westhaven.
Of course, said Mira.
Just let us know when you have an actual house built that has enough beds. Real beds, not straw on the floor. For everyone, said Tamsin. And you can bet we'll be right there. We laughed a little, and we cried a little. I could tell the Westhaven party was getting ready to depart, and the reality of what was about to happen hit me hard. Another journey. Another upheaval in my life.
There you are, Adelaide.
It figures. I just had to look for where the most tears were around here. You two wouldn't believe all the tears in her household when we first met. Cedric came up behind me, and I pulled back from Tamsin and Mira so that I could hug him. Then I gave him a light punch in the arm. He was the one who caused most of those tears. And you've been smitten with me ever since. He turned as a shout came to assemble, and his face grew serious. We had another tearful round of farewells with Tamsin and Mira, and then Cedric took hold of my hand.
My lady, shall we?
We walked up to where our horses were waiting. Young, spry ones, not poor Lizzie. He helped me mount, and I cast one last fond look back at my friends. Ahead, the road stretched out of Cape Triumph and into parts unknown. Whereas the same sight, on the way to Haddison, had been foreboding, I suddenly felt like all the world's possibilities were before me. Cedric leaned toward me.
You know,
I hope this new insanity works out for us. I think it will, I told him. After all, the old insanity turned out pretty well. And we rode. This is Kristen C. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Glittering Court by Rochelle Mead. This program was directed by Garrett Scott, executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2016 by Rochelle Mead. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.